Welcome to CompTIA's Shark Bites podcast with Alan Shark, Executive Director at the Public Technology Institute.
Welcome to another episode of CompTIA Shark Bites, where we explore tech leadership in government and other facets. So, hi, I'm Alan Shark, Executive Director of CompTIA's Public Technology Institute, or better known simply as PTI. As you know, we present new episodes every other Thursday. So by all means, please consider subscribing wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Today, we continue with season two with a conversation with Mark Wheeler, Chief Information Officer, Office of Innovation and Technology for the City County of Philadelphia. Mark has been CIO for nearly 4 years. He oversees and sets vision for the city's IT and innovation department, comprised of application development, full stack data center, cloud operations, cybersecurity and networking, project management, procurement, GIS and analytics, telecommunications, digital equity, smart city, IoT pilots, and innovation consulting. He's responsible for an annual budget of $112 million, with $35 million in grants and $28 million in capital. He's also been a deputy CIO for enterprise data and architecture, chief geographic information officer, chief security information professional. He's been a city planner, and he's certified by the American Institute of Planners, AICP. Mark, you have an incredible career. You've done some amazing things with the city, county of Philadelphia. I'm so glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Mark has been the CIO for, I guess, 4 years now. Is that right? Or you're just reaching 4 years?
I'm just reaching 4 years.
Okay, and you're not new to the city. You oversee and set the vision for the city's IT and innovation department, comprised of all the applications, the full stack data center, cloud, cyber, the whole bit. You have an annual budget going north of $112 million. You have about $35 million that you are responsible for overseeing grants. You have a $28 million capital budget thereabouts. That's pretty impressive. But going back, you were the deputy CIO for enterprise data and architecture. You were the chief geographic information officer, and you're even certified in that as a geographic security information professional. You've been a city planner, and you've been certified by the American Institute of Planners. So you have done a lot. You have been with the city for a while. We are excited to talk with you today.
Great. Thank you.
So when we begin, I always start with what got you into where you are. How did you get there? Because I find that so often the routes to get us to where we are today are filled with turns, U-turns, curves, traffic circles. Starting in the early years, what was it that attracted you to technology and planning?
It was garbage, actually. I don't think anyone would be able to take how I got to CIO and repeat it, because you're right. It's full of twists and turns. It's not a direct path, and it didn't even start in technology. Like I said, it was garbage. I was a waste prevention specialist with the Cornell Cooperative Extension upstate New York. I left Michigan to take this incredibly exciting job for me, because I was this earnest, 20 something, and completely committed to, changing the world and doing it through environmental protection and education. And I left for a $19,000 a year job to help businesses in the Hudson Valley region, mid-Hudson Valley, reduce waste at the source. It was called source reduction then. We know it now as a sustainability or the circular economy, because we would work at partnering them with other businesses who had a waste product that they could use as feedstock. I worked with the major colleges in the area, like Bard and Marist and Vassar, to do programs like food waste composting on site, or get their environmental awareness committees engaged somehow to take some of the education materials we were preparing and expand their recycling programs to become a reuse or waste prevention program. And then I did education in the schools. And I was working with the cooperative extension, but located with a nonprofit called the Dutchess County Environmental Management Council, and they provided advisory roles to all of the different towns within their county. And they had started to ask me to kind of fill a niche where they didn't have expertise on recycling or solid waste at those government levels. And at one point I was asked to put together a, with the county's operation, a household hazardous waste program. And I looked at our nonprofit's GIS team, which was mostly on natural resources and mapping open space and doing planning work. And I thought, and so a light bulb went off. And I thought, well, if we have an idea of where the people are and where our household hazardous waste centers could be, and if I looked at like driving distances and we thought about the amount of materials they had to bring and kind of try to calculate this all together, could we optimize for the best locations for these centers? And that was my first project working with the GIS director there. Started to do that work on my own time. There were so many vacation days with this nonprofit. I could actually go to night, take some grad classes at night, and then intern with a landscape architecture firm that had a GIS team and was doing planning. And that's how I got into it. And from there, I went straight into the technology, geographic information systems, but I had always had this interest in just community work and community planning. So I got my master's in regional planning. Did even more graduate work in quantitative data analysis, what we would call data science now, and got a job with a consulting firm that was purely GIS, highly focused on government entities. And from there, you know, worked for a number of years and ended up in Philly and wanted to really work at planning for a little bit. So I did. But then I kept getting pulled back into the data side of things. I couldn't stay away from it.
Well, I have to tell you a quick story that sets the stage for my question. You know, Councilman O'Neill from the city of Philadelphia has been the chairman of PTI for all the years I've known him since we merged with CompTIA. He and I were at an ESRI conference a number of years ago, and we had 300 people on a Sunday morning to talk about what it's like in the governance models of being a GIS person. And we talked about things, and I was shocked to see that everybody was up in arms, and it became kind of like a gripe session of how many people were angry at their CIO for not recognizing the value of GIS. When you were in the city, did you ever encounter that kind of bias? We were surprised. We always thought that was a natural kind of link, but I've seen, you know, it's probably changed in recent years, but kind of like the disconnect between what GIS can do, especially in this data-driven age.
I see that a lot with my counterparts across the country. In Philadelphia, I did not see that. I felt like coming into Philadelphia in a planning commission, and I could see some gaps in terms of there was some very valuable data that was siloed in departments. But it wasn't as if the departments looked at the GIS teams as not having any operational role or any policy role. I think that there were ways in which we wanted to have more contributions than we were given. In some entities, you were just the map maker. It was still dots on the map. I think coming into my GIO role, I still fought against that in some areas, that it was just dots on the map and there was greater analysis. I think the greatest problem that we had in Philadelphia is that we were progressive on the open data side, but for a while we tended to treat that as the new shiny object and that we needed a whole new data analytics team to start working for us. When in reality, the subject matter experts and true data scientists were the GIS analysts in the departments. And there were folks who did GIS that didn't have that title. They were engineers, they were epidemiologists, they were criminal investigators who had a great set of skills and knew how to use the software and knew the principles behind the software, but yet we weren't treating them all as this collective entity for the value of analytics and how to move the city forward. And that's the work that I had been trying to do as GIO and then later as CIO, was to capitalize on that wealth of information and insights. And kept telling departments, we do not need another analytics team. We do not need to recreate the wheel. We actually have all of the right components. We just need to pull it together properly and enable it. And I think we did a great deal of that work to move that forward. I'm really proud of the teams that we have here working in that realm. Because honestly, I do think that they are now seen, especially in our streets and our police and our health departments, they are seen as integral to both operations and policy.
There's no greater fan than GIS than me. Being a non-GIS person, I appreciate it. I value it. I've been to Esri many times, and I'm the cheerleader. And I've now come across in the last 24 months, three CIOs of major organizations, cities and counties, that had a very strong GIS background. So it's kind of interesting. I think it suits one well because of the planning skills and the being able to visualize information and being able to share that with others, I think is a skill and a gift.
Yeah, for me, it's you're integrating so many different types of data that don't seem to have any compatibility, but when it's the integration and then seeing new potential out of bringing that information and layering it. So you may think of the visual sense of a layer, but it's also a quantitative analytical. There's a number of skills that you'd use in finance or you use in engineering that you apply to GIS in terms of correlations and regressions. And where does that lead you in some decision-making?
Yeah.
And I think people tend to undervalue that again, because of dots on a map. And that's what's behind the dots is what's important.
Totally agree. So here we're having a quote unquote normal conversation, but we have to go back to the fact that as this is being recorded, we're still in a pandemic. Many of us hoped that we would be talking about a post-pandemic environment. I'm sure that's to come. My biggest question now is, what have been the challenges that you've had to face? Because you've been in the thick of it to this moment. How has that changed your view of government, and how has that changed your staff's responsibilities?
I think it's changed it in two fundamental ways. One is that I think we've proven to ourselves that we can do big things very quickly when we have to, and we can actually do them. We can do them well. This is not a do it quickly or break things and then go back and pick up the pieces as long as you're making momentum. We prepared the city to go remote in a matter of weeks. And we did it in ways that we understood some of the security risks and gaps and kept moving forward on closing those. And it was not without problems. And also on the public side, as a public policy, we stood up a program to deliver free internet to K-12 and then pre-K-12 households. And that was work done in combination with philanthropy, but also our major telecommunication providers, and then a very, very small set of people here in city government who literally work 7 days a week for 2 months to operationalize something that in normal circumstances, non-pandemic, it would have probably taken us a year. And also to mobilize and get all of the departments into a virtual, purely virtual operation where they're accessing cloud productivity tools. They're no longer trying to hit network shared drives. That also, we had planned a year's worth of education around Microsoft Teams, OneDrive, SharePoint, and all of that. And we were going to go department by department. It was probably going to be a 2 years before we got everyone using it, and we were able to deprecate some network drives and some old operations. I mean, it happened in 2 months. And for some departments, it was a week. Mm. Like they just did it. You do it when you have to, and you really stop the hand wringing. You stop second guessing yourself. You stop trying to make it perfect, and you prioritize exactly what needs to be done and what the real outcomes that you're driving for are. And I think for most people, it was secure, accessible, and understandable. Like we could organize it in a way that made sense for us, and they just moved. It also said something about how much we hold on to information that doesn't have any value. Think about all the people who constantly print out things, the filing cabinets, the folders. People walked away from all of that and didn't seem to need to come back to it. So to me, it said something very, very important about how we prioritize our information and how immediacy of information has the greatest currency. But, and I mean that in two different ways, spatially or temporally and in terms of value. So I'll stop there. And
yeah. Do you see, are you now required to come back to work physically? Are you working in a hybrid environment? What's the situation in the city now?
We're working in a hybrid environment. The mayor's office took the position that the departments could determine you know, what worked for them best within a set of parameters. And our chief administrative officer helped set all of those guidelines and had been working through the entire pandemic, you know, shifting those guidelines around, like what did it mean for our non-represented and represented employees and all of our healthcare, I'm sorry, all of the health protocols that we needed to constantly update and shift around. That was managed centrally by our administrative officer and OHR. So on an IT perspective, my executive team and I decided on a plan whereby the team members would only have to come in 2 days a month. And my goal was for them to meet as teams, actually get some cohesion going, except for cases where we have to have people on site 24/7. We do have data centers that require 24/7 staffing and monitoring, and that never changed during the pandemic. So they were coming in, I was coming into the office, you know, checking in on those folks. We had our what we call unified communications team, that when they felt it was safe to go back in the field, they started coming back into the office and mobilizing. So there's been folks who have really never left our office environment, and some who have never haven't seen it since March 2020.
Yeah, I have an office somewhere at the university. I'm worried about a sandwich I may have left there, you know, 2 years ago. I would think the data center is probably one of the safest places to be, given the environmental controls, you know, in terms of humidity, air, and natural spacing. So that's not a bad place to be.
It has some great, it has some great spacing, and it also we have shelter in place ability to support those teams overnight, and that's we've had to put that in place, you know, more than once.
We've heard from many of your peers that the pressures of having to work so many long hours, long days, working on help desk issues that they never thought they would have to do, like educating staff how to, you know, fix up their broadband at home and the like. Mm-hmm. Has that taken a toll morale-wise on your staff? In other words, are you experiencing any kind of burnout?
Yeah, I think the toll is real because it's not just the amount of work. It is the pandemic itself. So there's a personal family toll. We had that year with kids out of school, which for so many parents was incredibly, incredibly difficult. I think it was the challenge of, I don't feel as productive. I'm constantly distracted. And for high performers, I think that was the hardest struggle, that they couldn't perform at the level that they used to. They had their family obligations. They had concerns, you know, over health that they were trying to manage. And what I recognized really early on that that's what I was seeing. It wasn't that they were burning out. It was an internal frustration they just could not resolve. And we basically needed to talk about it as an exec team, or I needed to have one-on-one conversations with some of those folks to say, it's a pandemic. It's okay. It is absolutely okay. I think we did multiple waves of meeting and going beyond what was required of us to get the city both operational. We had the protests of the summer that caused some issues. We had a number of malware incidents and constantly being attacked. We had the waves of the supply chain vulnerabilities that we had to react to. And the team steps up again and again and again. But what I've heard from them is they've never seen this high level of responsibility that never seems to have any end to it. And that's what's burning people out. There is a decision fatigue, there's an emergency fatigue. And how I've tried to deal with that is to make sure that we're using all of the money that we have that we're allocated to for staffing, that we build that bench so we get people some relief, and that people are taking vacations because these are, again, high performers tended not to, but I had to in some cases enforce it and tell them they had to stay. And if I saw them on their phone or responding to emails or messages, I told them to get off and, you know, take their time away and then try to get that message down to the supervisors and the managers that you needed to be looking out for that signs of fatigue, making sure people had some separations. And then it was my role, I think, also to go back to my counterparts across the city when they were demanding something, to say, this is the timeline, this to set expectations and to set some boundaries again, which everyone understands. I mean, all teams across the city are dealing with the same thing. So it's just, those are conversations that people are open to. These are not fights that you end up having about getting resources done, getting resources allocated, people understand.
So we're seeing through CompTIA statistics and research that tech positions are hard to come by, meaning hard to fill rather. It's a very hot market. As you build your bench, have you encountered any issues having to do with supply and demand and finding good talent?
Yes, we've always had an issue with what I call the mid-career professional. They are the individuals that you need a level of technical experience so they could still act in the stead of one of their, you know, key or senior staff members, but they have the soft skills to lead a team and to direct and to problem solve. Those have been the ones that we've had the hardest time filling. We have a residency requirement in Philadelphia, and I think that that's one of the big challenges there, because if it were one individual coming, I think they can make that choice, but they now have a partner or a spouse that has their own career, and moving to the city doesn't either allow for that. At this point, they can't do hybrid, and it's a change of school environment if they have children. So you're dealing with more than just one. I call it the 2 to 3 body problem, because it really is.
Yeah.
But we've had a hard time with that. I don't see any change, honestly, because that has always been the hardest thing for us to fill. It's probably now with the attrition where people see more lucrative paying positions and they have been experiencing the burnout and they just need to change.
Yeah.
So that's been the thing that we're seeing the most.
So
people leaving their roles.
Yeah. And I think we're going to see more of that. Whenever you have a rising economy and you know you can make 40% more somewhere else, that's tough to compete with. I had a meeting recently with my counterparts at the state CIO level. And one thing that seems to be common among all is we're dealing with a new problem. That is, there is money on the table with all the, you know, we've had 3 acts of funding and the third act is yet to come, but all this infrastructure money, if we ever see it, there's a whole bunch of money having to do with cybersecurity funding. There's a whole bunch with broadband and IT modernization. Are you getting your fair share? I mean, are you at the table trying to figure out how these monies can best be spent as you see it?
Yes. The mayor's office, when in anticipation of some of these bills that have come through Congress, especially the infrastructure bill, we had been meeting regularly to define what our ask would be and how we would, you know, use that money effectively if we could get it. So I've been focused from my perspective on the external needs, again, with the digital divide, and what more we could be doing. I'm very happy to see the subsidies that have come through from the Emergency Broadband Fund, what they're doing with the ECF for our institutional providers, our libraries. But we definitely have been lobbying for expansion on some of those, because like with the ECF, I feel our rec center should be able to get that the e-pay rate or the e-gov rate that our libraries get. Our rec centers are serving the same exact role. People are coming there for information. They're coming there to use our public computing centers. They are safe spaces for after school. It's no different than the libraries. It's a learning center as much as it is a recreation center. And on the cybersecurity side, 100% staying on top of that, because there's no end to that need. We have to now deal, like I was saying earlier, with that supply chain problem. That just takes more capacity, because our software providers, as great of a partnership as we have with folks, Juniper, AWS, Microsoft, Dell, when there's an issue, I'm not sure we can rely on them to solve it. We may be doing that ourselves. And with a couple of those, I don't want to name any names, but with a couple of them, it was just on us. I appreciate the guidance they were giving, but they had to give it to the entire country. They couldn't help with individual entities. And that some of that was a little nerve-wracking, because it did affect some high priority business operations. I can say with confidence that we did not have indicators of compromise, and it was not as if we had identification of an intruder inside, but we recognized what that gap could mean, and we acted on it as quickly as we could.
So money is not an issue for a while, although I do worry about what's going to look like in 2024, well, 2025, when suddenly the sugar high is gone, and now suddenly we're left with what?
Yeah, it still is for us. I haven't, those security dollars haven't come yet, and the infrastructure dollars haven't come, which are the two most important things from my perspective. I know that the dollars are helping take off pressure in other parts of the city government operations, which in fact does help us at IT. If there's money coming in that we can now utilize for a solution procurement or for a project, which has a solution procurement or has some type of change management, process change management that we need to be a part of, that's capacity dollars that we can utilize. So I'm happy to see that there in other parts of the government.
So switching gears to a more general topic, what do you love most about your job? Because it's never ending. I mean, the list is so long. I don't even know how you sleep at night, but you must, maybe you can tell us if you have a secret, but what do you love most?
You know, there has to be, I think, that mission-driven a part of yourself to enjoy what can be very difficult parts of this position. So I have a great team. There are people who come to work, you know, virtually now, and they have enthusiasm. We love problem solving. Like you said, there's no end to the problems, but it's the problems I think I'm most interested in. They're both from a data perspective, and they're a solutioning for the public. These are real problems that can change people's lives or improve their lives. And I have gotten feedback from the public when we do something right on a UX design, and we've made the digital service that much easier to utilize. People don't necessarily go out of their way, but folks that I know who notice those things will say something that just, you know, makes it all worth it. That they recognize it, that it got easier. We got stats from our Department of Records when we launched a brand new application that got rid of 12 different apps that people might have to use. And they said, you know what, this is pre-COVID, but the number of people standing in line and waiting for service has dropped by more than 50%. So that means we know that they're getting served through this online service where all of our records are now available and you can make these requests. And those are the types of wins that you want to continue to hear about and see, that we're just making government easier for people. We're reducing the friction between services between departments is also the next biggest goal for us. I think we're really good at one level of service. It's that interchange between our departments where you have to bounce between licenses and taxation or licenses and health department. That is the next big hurdle.
They're
going to
tell you we've been doing it this way successfully for all this time, and we don't want to change. Change management is quite a challenge.
That's where I can't wait to get certain people in front of a whiteboard when we can all get together, masked or unmasked, and like post-it noted up there, and let's see if it's for real. Let's see if the handoffs are actually happening, or we're imagining a different outcome than what our partners are seeing in another department. I think those are the important eye-opening experiences for someone to see their process in front of them and see where it leaves off and another one picks up and where the value is there for your partners.
And you just provided an example a little bit earlier in this conversation when you talked about the fact that a lot of these files and all this paper was, you know, suddenly left, and suddenly there was a sense maybe we didn't need that. So that would be something that before the pandemic, people say, no, we've got to have that. And then suddenly the perspective changed, the environment changed. And that would be another example of what you're getting at here.
Yeah, paper is a security blanket. And so is mythologizing why you do something in city government. So much mythology. It's the law. Well, there's not a law. Well, it's a regulation. What's not a regulation? It's a policy. It actually isn't written down as a policy. It's just, we just ended up doing it this way, and we taught the next set of employees to do it the same way, and everyone just believed it had to be done.
I'm assuming, given the pandemic and how you have risen to all these challenges, that technology in the city of Philadelphia has risen in terms of the city leadership and the mayor. I mean, have you experienced that where now suddenly they really value tech? I mean, they probably always did, but now they really are seeing the role that you all have played.
I don't know if it's technology as much as what the team does to enable the technology, that when the need was there, they got the right level of handholding and they got the right level of courteous response, thorough explanations. again, responses when something didn't work over and over again. And on the security side, we've been beating the drum and doing education going back. I started in January 2018. I think by the end of the year, if not early 2019, we had launched the cybersecurity awareness in a much more formalized way and have been carrying it forward. That served us a great deal. And I think people recognize that when we'd had email compromises, when they had the, I know that there was a wave of the unemployment benefit fraud that was happening. There are lots of emails going around, like trying to get you to, you know, divulge something and be part of that fraud mechanism. So many people around city government recognized that those were phishing emails. Something wasn't right. They were emailing our security team. I was getting emails from folks like, this doesn't look right. Is that true? What do I do? I'm supposed to delete this, right? Exactly. Like, thank you for notifying us. That's the right step. Deleting is the next right step. That's the real awareness also that has bubbled up over time, is the appreciation for the level of security work that we've been doing to keep these operations as secure as we can. And it's a never ending battle. Not patting ourselves on the back. I don't want to draw any attention.
Well, but I think technology staff, I think you answered correctly, and I probably should have stated it better, that the function that you provide has been better appreciated than ever before, because they could see the benefits. It's not any of the pieces of technology, because those are nothing but tools. Mm-hmm. It is your staff, your vision, and the ability to pivot in a remarkable amount of time, and where people are suddenly really, wow, tech did that. Wow, this is really meeting people, not the technology. The people, yep, really, the people. Rose. Yeah.
And I think it's also recognizing that there are many individuals involved here, that it's not just software developers that tend to get the attention, because that's what happens in most of our media we talk about, but it's the network, it's the support center, it's the field engineers who are doing the wiring and the cabling, it's the folks who've been imaging the laptops, it's our project managers, who without whom many of these technology solutions just wouldn't have gotten off the ground with some of our departments, without someone to shepherd, be the experts on what the procurement needs to look like, how you guide people through the decisions, how you introduce the change management, and who's going to do the change management. We've got a whole project management team that I'm really proud of that's been doing that effort. And I think that's the one that people have recognized the most in the pandemic, that you just needed folks who knew how to, where all of the levers were within government and how they applied to technology and how we got a new solution in place quickly.
Well, I've seen that manifest with your Smart Cities initiative. As you know, your city won an award from PTI for one of your initiatives. And we interviewed one of your staff, Emily Yates. And I just saw this excitement, enthusiasm. And I wanted to get a take on your end about your vision for innovation. She certainly is an embodiment of that. But it's got to be an environment that you have created that allows people like her to get excited and do great things. How do you look at innovation in the city?
I think Emily is a great example of that. And so are members of our innovation management team who bring a multidisciplinary approach. They're incredibly curious. They are not experts in technology, but their goal is to achieve something real, and they're focused on measurable outcomes. And they're focused, they keep the guiding principles that we have in place about it being locally sourced and being equitable and being right-sized and correct for Philadelphia. We're not just trying to adopt something that some other city has done. It's really got to fit for us. I think when you have that multidisciplinary approach, there's just something inherent that makes you feel excited about bringing these people together and solving a problem, because many of the departments are struggling to move an agenda forward, whether it's improving sanitation services, it's improving the number. I know Emily talked to you about our Good Roads pilot project. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been trying to do the same amount of work with fewer dollars and maybe fewer people now for a few years. And you've got someone who's sitting beside you, problem solving from a whole new perspective, bringing multiple new perspectives into play, not being pie in the sky about it, and being very pragmatic about what could be done, leveraging We've got solution providers who just want to work with us to co-create and prove the worth and value of their product. And there now we've got someone in place who is very good at managing that and very good at bringing the requirements and the details to bear and keeping people on task. And so I think you can see if you're working in that space and you can continue to see little milestones achieved, it just feeds back into your sense that we can accomplish, again, we can accomplish bold things if we want to. And I try to be supportive of that. I try to troubleshoot and kind of clear the field. If there's obstacles in their way that I have the ability to manage and get out of the way, that's what I do that for folks like Emily and others on our innovation management team. And the same for any other team, whether it's our operations team, our GIS analytics team, or our field team, working with Verizon and AT&T on a big event that we're still having. We still have things that happen in the city. I'm glad to say we're having a conversation with FIFA about bringing the World Cup games here later a few years from now. So the events aren't right now, but we're still planning for them.
It's so exciting. I love the city of Philadelphia, and I've enjoyed very much talking to you. That's going to be it now. We've been talking with Mark Wheeler, CIO of the city of Philadelphia. And Mark, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. Great to see you again. And thanks for sharing your views.
This was great, Alan. Thank you.
This has been a production of PTI, the Public Technology Institute. To learn more, visit pti.org.